Next Step number 695, September 30th, 2021.
Hi there, this is Susie from In His Shoes Ministries. Thanks for tuning into the Next Step with Father Vazgen. We are the voice of Armadoxy, a weekly podcast started in 2008 that looks at life through the lens of Armenian Orthodoxy. We reach out to those who are searching for practical and deeper applications of faith, the disenfranchised members of the church community, and the neophyte, those who are discovering truths in ancient Orthodoxy. If you're joining us for the first time, we're so glad you're here. And if you're a regular listener, welcome back. Now, let's get ready to take the next step.
I would have never imagined, and I take it all back, okay? Put it out on the record, I take it all back. I don't know how I said it last week, but it was something to the effect that Pepron was a relatively unknown name. Holy moly, I didn't realize there were so many Peprons. Got notes from here and there. Oh, Pepron is not unknown. It is used. It has been in our family. In fact, even one Pepron in France. Thank you so much. Not only was her name Pepron, her grandmother's name, and her great-great-grandmother, her grandmother's grandmother, Pepron. Pretty popular name. I would have never known it. Anyway, we got some really good response to the Pepron edition. I'm glad you liked it. It was a special one for me because it just, like as I shared it with you last week, just kind of like came at a point where I needed that example, and I found St. Pepron, Febronia. Yes, and that was the other comment I got. I know. I mixed it up. It's a difficult name to say. I think here and there you caught me saying, yes, I was talking about the same individual, Pepron, Febronia, same individual. And if you have any doubts, just look in the show notes. Listen, I got a great show for you today, and it's great because of our guests. They're great. We go back almost 20 years. It was back in 2003, as many of you know, the In His Shoes movement was started. And it started with a group of young, I would say high school age. Yeah, there were a few junior high, but they were relatively young. And it came after a challenge that I had put out to them that what does it mean to you that you are sons and daughters or great-grandchildren of genocide survivors? And this group contemplated, and in fact, we had two great team leaders, Linda Maxwell and Jose Quintanar, were with us. We went out on a retreat, and we formulated an idea of what does it mean if we are removed from the genocide by some 90 years at that time. It was like 85, 80, 88 years, whatever it was, 2003. We are removed by 8 decades. What does it mean for us today? And I had put this question to them because we had gotten to a point where, okay, you go to your local demonstration, you complain against the Turks. And I think one of the big realities that hit, I don't know if you know, but in Turkey, April 23rd or 24th is a holiday, not for the genocide, of course, although I wouldn't put it past them to do that, but it is a holiday. So when we had these demonstrations, we would go to the Turkish consulate and there would be nobody in the consulate. Why? Because they were on their state holiday. And it begged the question that, what are we doing? Where are we going out there? What are we doing parading up and down the streets and yelling to buildings that have no occupants in it? And I think beyond that, it's the bigger question of, like, we don't have critical mass. You know, I remembered specifically 1991 when the first invasion of Iraq took place. And I remember Tony Blair being out on the streets of London with 1 million people protesting against a war in Iraq. And 1 million people was not critical mass. I mean, as you know, the United Kingdom entered into the war. 1 million people did not sway. I mean, you had 1 million people saying, no, don't do it. And I always think to myself, okay, we've got 10,000, got 20,000. On the 100th anniversary, we had 150,000. Not even a fraction of that. And we're out there. And where is our critical mass? So what can we do? How can we leverage what we do have, our resources? So this group of young Armenian adults, young adults, teenagers, we got together. We put them all together. And it was a brainstorming session. We came up with a very simple formula that for us to make sense out of who we are, it's an identity issue that really if we want to claim to be genocide survivors, that our grandparents were genocide survivors, we have to be worthy of that title by being able to address an issue today of genocide, namely that there are genocides happening in 2003. Darfur was just coming about. People were hearing about it. Rwanda had just happened. It had not been 10 years, but it was still in the back of our minds. We knew that there was genocide going on, that this word. I still had not gone to Rwanda. It was back in 2006 that I finally made the trip to Rwanda. So there was a lot of things going on, and the young people came up with this formula called In His Shoes, walking in the shoes of others, that you have to be able to help others. And so we went out to a few different events, and I met a Darfuri refugee who was wearing a t-shirt. I'll never forget it. We took a picture together, and the motto on that t-shirt became a motto by which I live until today. It says, the best way to mourn a genocide is to stop a genocide. Like, if you're going to think about, you know, something that happened 100 years ago, you better be willing to help stop one today. And it was in that atmosphere. There was a few players at that time, and one of the key players was Gabriel Starring. I got to meet Gabriel because of a project that he was doing, Camp Darfur, and we got our In His Shoes youth were involved with him. Later on, his wife joined in, and it was a very special, special time. It was in that atmosphere that we went out and we divested California to the tune of $5 or $6 billion, if I remember right. We went on a campaign that took our young people throughout the streets of Glendale collecting signatures and delivering those signatures to then Governor Schwarzenegger, who divested from the Sudan because of what was going on in Darfur. So there were some very, very major accomplishments. There was Don Cheadle had made the Hotel Rwanda movie. George Clooney was on the scene. We were able to meet with him. Just a very fascinating, fascinating time. And Gabriel was a key player in that entire thing of looking towards Darfur and helping out. And I think the greatest part was when he left all of the comforts of home and he went to Darfuri refugee camp. And one visit there became two visits, became three, became 10, became 30. And here is a man who actually walks the talk. And so I was very, very excited, and I shared this with you a few months ago when him and KDJ went to Armenia to work with, they were invited to Armenia to work with refugees of the Artsakh War, and specifically in this program that they have of teaching soccer coaches mindfulness, teaching how to address the issues of stress and trauma in these populations that have been hit by severe violence to the tune of genocide. I shared a little bit with you, and I told you we'd get to a point where we would be able to share some news. So what we did is we were able to be with them on Saturday night. They had a big fundraiser for IACT, iActivism. And by the way, I will put links on our show notes to everything that we talk about today. So you don't need to write them down, but you do need to go to the show notes so you can check out those links and you can participate by tuning in on all the good work that they're doing. So we were there Saturday night. It was a major fundraiser for iActivism. We got a chance to meet with other people who were supporters, who were on the ground, who were helping out, and just a wonderful group of people to be with. It's the kind of people you say, these are my friends, you know? And it's an honor for me to consider them my friends. I'm going to play for you an interview that we did just a couple days after that. Actually, I guess two days ago. We were at the Western Diocese at our studio there, and we did an interview. Yes, it is on YouTube, and you can watch it. But if you watch it, you're going to say, wow, this is a podcast. These people aren't moving. There's no action. There's no Godzilla coming in through the window. Why am I watching it? I would rather just listen to the audio. And you're doing right. That's what we're going to play for you. You know what? It's not that long. It's maybe about a little over 20 minutes and everything. So we are not going to break for the song of the day until after the interview. So here is an interview with Gabriel Starring, happens to be the founder and chief of vision and strategy for IACT and the executive director, Katie J. Starring. Let's listen in. Today in studio, to my right is Katie J. Starring. To my left is her husband, Gabriel Starring. Two individuals who just returned from Armenia. They were there for a very unusual task, and it was a mission, actually. And that's what we're going to be talking about. So first of all, welcome, and I'm glad you're with us today.
Thank you, Father V.
We want to find out, you're with the IACT, and we want to discover what IACT is, IACTivism is, and share with us the bigger story. So if we can we start off from the very, very beginning? Because our relationship, we go back about almost 20 years.
Almost
20 years, and it was a very special time because I was realizing as a survivor of genocide, my parents having gone through that, I realized that we had to do something for other people going through genocide. And all of a sudden, I hear about you. You were out on the field. And maybe if we can start from there, what was going on with you back then?
Yeah. So for me, I'm a Mexican, not a survivor of genocide. But I grew up in a family that my mom just cared about others. And I think that's where it started. And in 2004, 2005, this word started coming out again, and it was related to genocide in Darfur. Mm. And for me, it came at a point, it was the 10th anniversary of the genocide in Rwanda, and I'm old enough, as you can see from the gray, that when Rwanda was happening, I was an adult. I was seeing on the news. I was reading the paper about it, about this horrible event in our history where 800,000 people were massacred in 100 days. And thinking back to those days, I would just see it and go, that's too ugly. It's far. It's not connected to me. There's nothing I can do. So it was all these, you know, negatives of what I couldn't do. So I did nothing when Rwanda was happening. And then 10 years later, I start seeing Darfur in the news. At that point, I'm a father already. I'm working as a counselor for abused children and their families. So it hit me in a different way where I said, okay, I have no excuse. I just have to do something. Mm-hmm. And I thought I'd jump and do a little online activism, send maybe a little donation and continue with my life. But as I started to read the accounts of the Darfur genocide, I just every day said, what else can I do? So I started with what can I do, not what I cannot do. Mm-hmm. Probably in the first few months, I met up with you and with the Armenians. And what was beautiful is the connection that Armenians were making to their own genocide and saying, we went through that, now we have to act. And we just kept bumped into each other at every, activism action, planning. And it was always that positive thing. Okay, what can we do? And we would just do whatever we could. And that's when I jumped in fully and said, okay, we have to make it personal. And from that was my first visit to Darfur refugee camps on the Chad-Sudan border.
So to review, because it is one of those, it's the similarities between the Darfur and Armenian genocide, the genocide in Darfur and the one that took place in Armenia, are striking, not in so much as the events that took place, but the reaction of the world. It's basically a forgotten. Nobody was talking about Darfur back in 2003, 2004, 2005. I think it was your first visit there, right?
Right.
Yeah. And who's talking? Nobody even knew where Darfur was. And
yeah.
It just reminded me of like the Armenian genocide. Who knows where Armenia is? And there you were. You were doing that. And then what you did is you put together these camps for people, because I think that's the other part of it. It's not just that something's happening over there. Something's not happening here.
Right.
So you made Camp Darfur available for people. Can you tell us about that? Maybe a little.
Yeah, and that's actually how Gabriel and I met. So I started my activism in Portland, Oregon. I was a student at Portland State University, and Ruth Messenger from the American Jewish World Service came to visit. And she had just come back from the Chad-Sudan border. And I just remember sitting there listening to her and thinking, I cannot believe that the world's worst hate crime continues today. How are we as a world letting this continue after Armenia and the Holocaust and Rwanda and Cambodia? Like, how is this still possible? And that was my call to action. And I was organizing a small coalition, the Portland Coalition for Genocide Awareness, which had Armenians and Cambodians, and definitely the Jewish community. And we were doing an event, and somebody kept saying, this guy, Gabriel from LA, he has these tents, he has this exhibit, we should bring him. And I sort of said, okay, just have them shipped to my house. And we were on email, and, we did the first Camp Darfur that was in Portland, and it was, it placed Darfur in historical context along all the other promises, our failed promises of never again. So you can walk through Armenia and the Holocaust and Rwanda and Bosnia, Cambodia, and see the impact of the world looking the other way, and then get to the Darfur tent, and it's pictures of beautiful children and the people that we can act for today. In order to make sure that they have a future. And that was, that was one of our first exhibits. And afterwards, the organizers of a particular event went out to dinner, and I had my colleagues convinced Gabriel that he should hire me. And that, and Gabriel's response was, well, if you can raise your own salary, you can definitely join my team.
Sounds like our church, right?
Yeah. So she started as a volunteer, and it took her a while to find a salary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's, let's, just for the sake of our listeners, just so they know, Camp Darfur was an actual physical camp that was set up here in America, giving people an opportunity to walk through the camp.
Yeah.
What you might expect in a refugee
camp. Yeah, and it was just going to be one event here in LA in 2006, and you took on the Armenia tent, and it is different tents, like refugee tents, that were like I was seeing in the camps that I was visiting. So to represent displacement and that type of suffering, the loss of home, but then each tent had the story of a genocide, and the first one, the tent, was always Armenia, and then it would go on to the Holocaust in Cambodia, Rwanda, and different ones, and it was for a person to visit it, to go through it, but then step back and see the connection, see how we just have failed, but there's always the opportunity to do something now, so it was just going to be that one event, as it seems like everything we do. Now it's been in hundreds of places across the country, in universities, churches, communities. So,
and is it still going? Could somebody request a Camp Darfur?
We still have it. We still have Camp Darfur. Okay. We do less of them because of all our programming, but we pull it out of storage when needed.
Okay, so let's get to that programming, which is today. You used the word people who are displaced, and that word resonates with us because we are here as Armenians because we were displaced from our homeland. I mean, we talk about a genocide 100 years ago as the 1.5 million dying, but also we have a diaspora because of this genocide, and we're here. But today, specifically, I know that you returned from Goris, where just a year ago, We were under attack and displaced, right, from our historic homeland. And tell me a little bit about what happened this past year. Background story.
It is shocking that war again right in the Armenian region, and that the response was the same by the world, mm-hmm. looking the other way. Mm-hmm. So that's the most shocking thing. That, you know, war is shocking and horrible, but then the reaction is even more. So our connection to the Armenian story has been there from day one. And then the Aurora humanitarian community came to be in 2016, and I was one of their nominees for their prize. So we stayed connected with Aurora, and when war broke out, we immediately contacted them and said, you know, we have 17 years of experience working with communities affected by war. What can we do? And these are our programming. KDJ put together the list of, you know, everything that we could do. And after many conversations, they said, hey, bring your soccer program. That would be perfect to reach as many children as possible that have been affected by war. And our soccer program is this holistic whole child program that really creates a safe space for kids to heal, but then also to thrive. You know, it gives them a center of peace internal that then kind of gives them outside peace. So that's what brought us over to Gore, is to work with directly with the affected community.
So can we back up a little bit? The displaced community, where was this program tested? It was tested in Chad, right?
Yeah.
And maybe if we could back up to those refugee camps.
All of our programming originally started in Eastern Chad with the Darfur community at their request. Mm-hmm. I mean, we were activists. We started as activists. And our model of advocacy and activism is really connecting globally people and calling them into action. So when it was advocacy, it was human rights experts and everyday people calling them members of Congress, and it was members of Congress and connecting them and creating a relationship with the Darfur refugee community. And so when the community began asking for programs, early learning, preschool programs, a sports program, a football, soccer program to engage their young kids before they were in their teenage years, to kind of keep them in the camp, but also have a place for them to be kids again. We just did the same. We took the same model. Mm-hmm. How can we, you know, there's global experts in all of these things, in psychosocial help, in mindfulness, in football, in early learning, in trauma recovery, all of these things. How can we connect them with the Darfur refugee community and co-create programs that meet the needs of the refugee community still living in Eastern Chad? Mm-hmm. And that's how Little Ripples, our early learning program, started. And that's how Refugees United Soccer Academy started as well. And so we have frameworks that are then co-created, co-completed by the community, the displaced community that we work with.
So Little Ripples, when you say Little Ripples, it's actually a program.
It's an early learning program in Eastern Chad. It's in homes. Mm-hmm. We call them Little Ripples Ponds because they're like scattered mm-hmm. around the camp. And they're hosted in, they have host families hosted in their family area. It has a small area that is shaded, you know, protects them from some of the elements. It has latrines, a spot for the host mother and a neighbor to cook a daily nutritious meal. And then two teachers who are paid and employed by IACT come every day and engage around 45, 50 kids in play, wow. really, in social and emotional skills and play, which is really, really important.
So this program that you have that takes place in these refugee camps, you now pick it up and take it to Armenia.
Yeah. And what was amazing is that, you know, Eastern Chad is one of the most remote, harshest, forgotten places on earth. Mm-hmm. And we co-created these programs with that community. And then they started to get attention. We started to win awards. Now we've been contracted by UNICEF to inform countrywide early childhood curriculum. So we worked with Ethiopia, Malawi, Zambia, the Kingdom of Lesotho to inform their national curriculum on early learning. So it's just very rewarding to see that, you know, this little program that started in a refugee camp now is informing nations. Mm-hmm. And that same knowledge and expertise is what we brought over to the border, Armenia and Artsakh.
So you get into Armenia and you've given a bunch of kids, or what happened?
No, it was actually coaches. Okay. So we worked with a partner organization, Goals, mm-hmm. Girls of Armenia Leadership Soccer. And they pulled their coaches from areas that were impacted or had displaced community members from inside Artsakh who had come across the border and were in their communities. We pulled them all together and we did a 5-day training. 3 days, 3.5 days on the field. We would do a morning session. Then we would have lunch and do a sort of a classroom session on the values of the program, peace, helping, and sharing, strength-based coaching, mindfulness. And then we would go back in the afternoon and do another 2-hour session on the field. Our training sessions are all, they have an adult learning model, so it's experiential. So the folks are learning the information by practicing and by experiencing it themselves. So we would run the academy sessions exactly how we would want the Refugees United Soccer Academy session to run by the coaches that we selected at the end. So we went in thinking we want to pick the best possible coaches who can reach as many children who've been impacted by the war as possible. So mm-hmm. keeping an open mind, not knowing exactly the number, but which personalities surface? Who's there to play but is also joyful, is paying attention, can see the big picture mm-hmm. of how important social emotional learning and mindfulness can be woven in with the sport of football? And then who's just a joy to be with? And then on the last day, we had kids and we got to see them interact with kids themselves. And then we chose 3 coaches. So we have 3 academy coaches that, again, we really strongly believe in paying a living wage. So they are paid and hired coaches. And they've been running academy sessions with children, both in Goris, in a neighboring village, Tesh, and then going inside Artsakh, and then sometimes some coaches from Artsakh bring kids to Goris, and just trying to touch as many kids as possible through the academy model.
And it's very much just the first trip. So we saw that as an opportunity to immediately get to work with the community, but then also to kind of get the lay of the land and see what opportunities are there to have a greater impact. And we feel really good about the impact we can have together with the people of Armenia and Artsakh. It's something that you can wrap your mind around. The numbers are, you know, reachable. We see this as an initial 3-year investment of our resources and just getting in there and making sure that every family that was affected by the war does not feel the way that Darfuris felt and the way that wow. all these other communities have felt forgotten, that they know, hey, there's people that care about us. And again, that kids are not just surviving, but that they can thrive. It just should not be that children go through that trauma and then that wound just stays with them.
Mm-hmm. I think on that same note, we talk, the media talks a lot, or people like myself who has not, my family has not experienced genocide. We talk about this idea that people are resilient and they've lived through things. I think what IACT wants to do is offer the tools for children and coaches and teachers and parents to build resilience in themselves, mm-hmm. not because they've gone through something horrible. Right, we should be acting before war happens, before violence happens, and when it happens and before it happens, is there a way where we can help heal some of the wounds in ourselves and build personal resilience so that we can continue to live with purpose? I think, yeah, the media a lot likes to say, look at the Armenians, look how resilient. It's a romanticized version of resilience. And instead, I want kids to go and play and score goals and say, look how powerful I am. Mm-hmm. And that's the source of resilience, right? The source of resilience is being in company with other kids, you know, being able to feel a heightened sense of like anxiety and be like, oh, I can breathe. I have my breath. I have control of it. Let me just, oh, I'm here. I'm in a safe place. Look at my soccer coach. My mm-hmm. soccer coach is checking in with me. He or she cares about me, right? And that's where the resilience and the strength comes from that safety net, from that community that is rebuilt after something horrible like war or violence has happened to people. So I think part of what I act, you know, football, I love football. I was, you know, I played in college and I'm a player. And so I love football. And at the same time, I just want kids to feel that amazing, that they are amazing because they are in a safe place. And I know that the football field can create that safe space for kids to be themselves and be strong.
Can I ask something that I'm sure that people are thinking about? You're going to Armenia, and we know we are very familiar with Armenia. And you're a woman. You're teaching coaches.
Yeah.
Are you? Everybody yeah. just accepted? That's fine.
Yeah, I mean, I think in some parts of the world, and maybe in Armenia, they sort of looked at me and said, "Well, what can this lady teach me?" Mm-hmm. And I think the combination of the way in which we approach the academy is very different. And then I think I was able to back it up with actual soccer skills. So we're going to do this and I can offer some very, you know, concrete soccer skill oriented feedback. And I can say, we're not just about the sport, right? We're not just about that one child being able to pass perfectly. We're also about supporting them in a different way with positive reinforcement. And I think just the more, I'm also very loud and straightforward, so I think that helps.
She was a tough player. She is. So I think some of that came through. But yeah, there was a little bit of, you know, the first meetings, some of the men, you know, were, you know, not as old as me. One was older. But, you know, decades of coaching. And, mm-hmm. And yeah, you could see that, like, what is she going to teach me? And then what is this mindfulness thing? So you could see the men kind of, the women were a little bit more there, and they were players too, with experience. So that, it wasn't like in Eastern Chad where women had never played. Mm. So that was great. But you know, day one, by the second session, you know, they were already starting to smile. They were kind of getting the groove of it. And then at the end, one of the men that started the most serious of them all, we had our kind of closing circle and we're saying, you know, what was this experience like for you? And one of them said, you know what? I started angry. Like I started in that first circle and all this, and I just felt angry. Why am I here? And then I just got it and I've enjoyed it so much. And from that second session all throughout all day, he had a smile on his face. Every single moment, every time you would look at him, he was the most joyful guy. So that was great to see that they did get it. And if they could feel that, I know that they can imagine what it does for a child that might, you know, come in with some anxiety and some of the trauma that is left over from displacement.
Sure. Now I think you saw a transformation over there. I think you're going to see a transformation over here. People want to know, how can they get involved? How can they learn more about you? How can they participate in this really, really important?
That's what IX is all about. We have a tiny staff here in the United States and in California. But our model works because it is this culture of participation where anybody can jump in and say, this is who I am, this is what I have, how can I help? And we find ways that, you know, teachers, football coaches, players, English majors with editing. So we have, you know, so many ways for people to get involved. Of course, donations always help. You know, we're going to pay salaries. We're going to bring equipment. We see this as a long-term investment. We want to bring little ripples out there. We think that it is so important to offer those early ages an opportunity. It's 90% of brain development happens during that time. If they experience trauma, that's going to stay with them. Mm-hmm. So that we have to address also. So we're going to be going back as soon as we can and people can go to our website, iac.ngo, and connect with us.
Okay.
Yeah, so, I think the other thing that I want to offer up is that when we will be returning to Armenia soon, we're trying to figure out if we'll do that in the winter time, which we're from California, so I'm like a little bit nervous about how much snow will be there. But what we've seen in some of the other communities that we've been in is that the personal messages are so meaningful.
Yeah.
So if you're part of a community and you want to send messages, so these can be handwritten messages from children to children. They can be, you know, messages of support to the soccer coaches. It can be written. It can be a signed soccer ball from your team to, you know, one of the academies where they get to pick it up and say, oh my gosh, look at my peer living in Glendale or Burbank or somewhere in the United States. They know me. They see me. I'm accompanied. I'm not abandoned. So those messages, you know, again, it can be on a piece of paper. It can be on a soccer ball. It can be in the form of a video. We could compile a whole bunch of videos, you know, of people sending messages. I think, you know, Gabe went back to Chad and in May, late May and June, and we hadn't been since before COVID. And they have been able to, because we leave no foreign staff on the ground. So they're able to sort of start and stop programs as it's safe during COVID at this moment. But what they asked Gabriel was, what more can we do? And the most meaningful thing that you've done is come back. So we do want also, again, Gabriel, yes, so donations are important. We have t-shirts and soccer balls and, you know, all of the things to raise money. And we want to pay salaries of our coaches and just communicating and accompanying the folks in Armenia who've been impacted by the war is also important.
So we have the most amazing three coaches right now. And we think we can do it 10 times what we're doing right now. But Sergey, Nelly, Anush, every day they're sending us pictures and videos of the work they're doing. They're reaching hundreds of kids. We can reach thousands.
So we're going to be able, if we go to the website, we'll be able to see these pictures, these videos. Yeah. I was just reminded that, you know, it was maybe about 10 years ago, we made a video that you took with you to the refugee camp in Chad. It was Armenians here saying, don't give up. And it was a beautiful video, not because we sent it, but what you brought back to us. It was a video of them watching.
Yeah.
Watching me, watching you. It's like, wow. It was like transformative in many respects. Sure, we thought we were doing them a favor, but we were the ones who got the blessing at watching their reaction to that.
Yeah, the connection. Yeah. The connection. Again, people that go through this feel alone because in many ways they are. People do not act to protect them. But then when they find out that someone cares and they get to meet them and see them and know that they're being seen, that's transformational. You know, food is important, water, shelter, but this connection is just another essential need for a human.
I also think that it's the only way that we're going to break the cycle of violence that is endemic in refugee communities. If we can continue to be engaged and to accompany and to listen and to participate, then we're more likely to act to stop the next genocide.
Yeah, in 2 weeks, we're heading out to the Central African Republic, another tiny place. There's this beautiful country in the center of Africa that nobody knows about. And they go through cycles of the most horrific genocidal violence. The country explodes. It's one of the most dangerous places on Earth right now. People just, you know, it's hard to be connected with all of it, but that's the places that we want to find and that we want to be in.
Sure. Wish you the best from all of us. I want to just share with our listeners right now that we'll flash the website on your screen. Make sure you check them out. You're watching Ushatru Tiangetran. We talk all the time about church, about what's going on. It's about not just something place that you limit your faith on Sundays, but every single day living out that faith. And today you see some examples of people who are out there who are risking it, who are sacrificing. That's a big word these days because it's always put in some kind of context of religiosity rather than practicality. These are people who are sacrificing, giving of themselves, and I just can't emphasize enough how important it is for all of us to feel what they're going through. We have a beautiful expression in Armenian called tsavatanem, let me understand your pain. It literally means let me walk in your shoes, let me be that person who could take and understand your pain. Thank you for understanding our pain. Thank you for everything you've done. And on behalf of everybody, I want to wish you all the best. Any parting shots?
Well, Father V, you've been walking the walk from day one. And I always remember that you've always said that when you saw us going to the refugee camps and visiting people there, that it was as if seeing us visiting your grandmother. And that stayed with me, and that connection and that sense of responsibility beyond your own community for me has been inspiring. So I just look forward to walking with you.
Sounds good. I look forward to it, too. Thank you so much for being here. By the way, I went to an incredible fundraiser Saturday for them. I'm going to make a shameless plug without any problem. Beautiful T-shirts, soccer ball. I got the soccer ball. It's got that beautiful pomegranate on it. And if you want it, it's all at their website, okay? So please check it out. Thank you so much for being out here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Amazing, isn't it? Amazing that there are people like this that leave the comforts of home and they go and they sacrifice themselves, their times, their talent, their resources in helping others. That's why earlier when I told you, it's to me, it's an honor and a privilege to consider them my friends. Let's take a break right now, as we do every week. Gives us a little bit of time to just kind of sort out things. And here's a song I picked out for this week. Pialto is this week's featured artist, doing, of course, Joe Cocker fame, You Are So Beautiful. Pick the song out for a couple reasons. First of all, Pialto is a talent that you have to get to know. All right, there's no ifs, ands, or buts. She's just fantastic. I will have a link on today's show notes. Make sure you check out the artists. And as I always say, if you enjoy these artists, that's why I play them. So you get to know them, support them too, you know. Purchasing a small little music clip from them, an MP3 file, means the world to these artists, because it's saying that, yeah, there are people out there who are listening. So do check her out. RP Alto is the artist. The other reason I played this is because this past week we've had to deal with a few soldiers from the war in Artsakh, and in particular working with them at different levels. And in particular, there's some major post-traumatic stress disorder. And we always say this very, I don't know, it's almost one of those familiarity breeds contempt issues. You know, we see, oh, it's PTSD, you know. And so, well, it's not PTSD. It's truly traumatic. I mean, just the idea that you would bring it down to an acronym is kind of refusing to acknowledge that it is trauma. It is huge. It's traumatic. Their whole lives have changed. I just wanted to play a small little song that says, "You are so beautiful. You are beautiful, and you are to me, you are to a lot of people." And I ask for all of you to pray for these young men and women who've really seen the worst of the worst. It was exactly a year ago, this past weekend, that the Azeris attacked Armenia. And I want to share some thoughts with that when we come back, okay? RP Alto, "You Are So Beautiful." Check out the show notes. Last Sunday was the first anniversary of the war in Artsakh. It's one of those anniversaries that just leaves you wondering, what is... Last Sunday was the first anniversary of the war in Artsakh. 44-day war that left thousands killed, even more thousands injured, and of course, the loss of very special historic land that belonged to the Armenian people for centuries and gone. Because of a world that just could care less about it, because of Turkey and their desire for pan-Turkism, expansionism, because of Azerbaijan, because of greed of others, because of a lot of reasons. And you just look at the world and you go, what is going on? I struggled with a set of words that are recited during our divine liturgy. They come from Psalm chapter 24. And it is a question and answer session that takes place between the priest and the deacon. The deacon says, "Lift up your gates and let in this King of Glory." And the priest says, "Who is this King of Glory that he is able to overcome war, that he could even do battle and overcome war?" And this is repeated every Sunday. And I thought to myself, you know, it was repeated last year exactly at the time that the war began. And at what point do we make those connections where we say the faith that we articulate on Sundays needs to make sense, needs to bring into context what is happening? And sadly, I just see too many people just blindly accepting this idea that somehow God is on the outside fighting wars, like, you know, that Superman mentality. Like, if we pray hard enough, he'll come out of the sky and he'll just end everything. And sadly, there's a lot of people who buy into this instead of understanding that we need to take responsibility for our lives and for the world that we have. So I wrote a little piece, and I'm going to share it with you. I'll put it on today's show notes. I want you to look at it, and I would really love to hear your comments. It's about the King of Glory, a Q&A, and I would love to hear from you. I would love to hear your comments. Listen, we are at the end of today's show, and just before Susie... No. The pianist is here. All right, Susie, make your announcement. I'll be back in a couple moments, okay?
Before getting back to the Next Step with Father Vazgen, I'd like to take this opportunity to remind you that this ministry is supported through the heartfelt donations of listeners like you. Thanks for keeping us in your prayers and partnering with this expanding and dynamic outreach. The Next Step is entering homes and communities with a solid message proclaiming God's message of love, forgiveness, and compassion. We look forward to your comments and words of encouragement. Please consider partnering in this dynamic ministry by making a contribution. By pressing on the donate button on our website, you can set up automatic donations, either weekly, monthly, or annually. Your donation goes a long way in furthering this ministry. Even more, tell your friends and family by sharing the Next Step link or website with them. We're on iTunes and Blueberry, as well as Facebook and Twitter. We are excited about this ministry and invite you to share in our enthusiasm. This is Susie wishing you all of God's blessings in your life. We now return to the Next Step with Father Vazgen.
Thank you, Susie, for that announcement. And thank you to all of you for all the wonderful prayers, the love, the support, and especially those comments. You know, they go a long way. I read them, I get excited. You could drop me a line at feedback@epostle.net. That's apostle with an E. Apostolic Evangelism for an Electronic and Expanding Universe. Listen, you know, we're going to get together again next week. In the meantime, we have all kinds of things that are going on. I'm going to be doing a walk through the old hood on Saturday. Sunday, we should be at the cathedral. On Monday, we have our Questions of Faith series. During the week, we have revamped the AC 202 series, and there'll be a new one coming out this coming week about consecration. And then we'll be back again for the Next Step next Thursday. In the meantime, do check out inhisshoes.org, where you'll find links to what we talk about, the show, just about everything else. And also, we are on most of the socials, okay? On behalf of the wonderful crew who put today's show together, first and foremost, I thank our dear guests, Gabriel and Katie J. Starring, for a wonderful interview, for making the time, and most importantly, for doing and being the people that they are. On behalf of Susie, our producer, this is Father Vazgen inviting you to join us again next week when we will take the next step.
And now here's the fine print. The information and comments presented within this podcast and our website do not necessarily represent the views of the Armenian Church hierarchy, but are presented as a challenge to define the dynamics of Armenian Orthodoxy in all aspects of life. Listening to these shows is habit-forming. Addictive behavior associated with the Next Step is rarely, if ever, remedied. Rather, the Next Step is known to relieve and cure common cases of narrow-mindedness, prejudice, numbskulledness, and glaucoma in patients over the age of 20. Results may vary depending on credit rating. Findings are based on double-blind studies conducted in Istanbul and Jerusalem. Side effects include mind expansion, clarity of focus, higher rates of heart palpitations, sensitivity to the pain of others, and occasional nausea. The management and production crew of epostle.net take full responsibility for changes you will experience. Not valid with any other offer.
Off, but I'm top limits.